Chapter 32. Guy rode back to Smithfield with us. There he turned left into town, bidding us farewell.
Shall I see you at the Bedlam tomorrow morning, Matthew? I'm going at 9 o'clock.
I agreed to the rendezvous, then watched him for a few moments, a lonely figure in the country road, his stoop noticeable as he rode away.
Now, Matthew, Harsnett asked, what is it that you've worked out? What are in those little boxes that Barrack's carrying?
I told them what I believed. Lockley had been keeping secrets, the Dean too, and perhaps Cantrell.
Maybe we should talk to Cantrell first, Barrack suggested. See if he can confirm it.
We can talk to him afterwards,
Harsnett answered grimly.
I want to confront the Dean directly.
You should go home, Jack, I said. See Tamasin. He shook his head.
No, I want to see the end of this.
He looked at me, and I saw that, like Harsnett and me, he had been deeply shocked by what had been done to Mrs. Bunce.
I wish we could have saved her, he said.
We rode down to Westminster. It was a Saturday. Parliament and the courts were shut. There were fewer people around. Shopkeepers and peddlers eyed us as we passed, and one or two called out, but we ignored them. In the sanctuary, we passed a big cart loaded with planks of newly cut wood. The resin smelled sweet in the foul town air. The cathedral doors were closed, but we heard the sound of hymn singing from inside, the choir, no doubt, preparing for service. I wonder where the Dean is, I said.
We will go to his house.
We rode on to Dean's Yard, passed under the wall into the Abbey courtyard, and once again tied up the horses outside the pretty old house, standing amidst the chaos of building works. Inquiries of the steward revealed that Dean Benson would be occupied in the cathedral all day. Harsnett sent a message asking him to attend us on a matter of urgency which might involve his personal safety.
That'll bring him, he said as the steward hurried away, leaving us sitting in the entrance hall.
In a short time, we heard footsteps approaching up the garden path. The Dean entered. He was breathing heavily. He must have hurried over as soon as he got the message. He looked at us angrily.
What in the name of heaven has happened now? He demanded. Why do you say I'm in danger?
May we speak in your office? Harsnett asked.
Very well.
The Dean sighed and led us down the corridor, his cassock rustling. After a few steps, he turned, staring at Barrack, who had followed us, carrying Lockley's boxes.
And you propose to bring your servant to an interview with me?
He asked me haughtily.
Barrack comes too this time,
Harsnett said, looking the Dean hard in the eye. We had agreed this beforehand.
He has something to show you.
The Dean looked at the boxes Barrack carried, shrugged, and walked on. Once in his office, Harsnett told the Dean of Ethel Bunce's murder, Lockley's disappearance, and the attack on Cantrell.
So you see, Dean, he said, the killer seems to be focusing his attention now on those associated with the infirmary.
Why should that endanger me?
The Dean looked at the boxes on Barrack's lap and took a sudden deep breath. I saw that he guessed what they might be. There was a connection between you and them, I said.
More, I think, than the mere fact that you had overall authority over the monks' infirmary and the lay hospital.
I think that's what you've been hiding. Barrack opened the boxes, revealing the dentures. From the way the Dean's eyes widened and he sat back in his chair, I knew my suspicions were right. Let me tell you what I think happened, I said quietly. Goddard used to administer Dwale, a powerful and dangerous soporific to render people unconscious for operations. Meanwhile, a fashion came in among the rich for wearing false teeth set in wood. The teeth are usually obtained from healthy young people, preferably as a complete set. Master Barrack's wife recently had to have a tooth removed, and the tooth drawer suggested he pull out the lot, offering to pay her well for them.
Is there some meaning to this story?
The Dean asked angrily. But his eyes kept going back to the boxes.
I don't know how often you visit the abandoned parts of the old monastery now, but I've twice encountered a beggar who keeps sneaking into the premises asking anyone who will listen if they know where his teeth are. He hasn't a tooth in his head. He's mad, of course, but I wonder what drove him so. Something that was done to him here? Perhaps his teeth were removed under Dwale? Perhaps they were checked for size against one of these boxes we found in Lockley's chest. One of the reasons the tooth drawers find it hard to get people to volunteer their teeth even for high sums is the pain involved. But destitute folk who came here to have their illnesses treated could be offered a dose of Dwale to make the process itself painless.
There was silence in the room. A loud hammering began somewhere outside, making the Dean jump. He took a deep breath.
If Goddard and Lockley and Cantrell, for all I know, had some scheme going in the infirmary, I knew nothing of it. And what does that to do with your hunt for the killer?
We need to know all, Dean. And from the way you looked at those boxes, it's clear this is not news to you.
A second hammer joined the first. The Dean closed his eyes.
That noise, he said quietly. That endless noise. How am I supposed to be able to think?
He opened his eyes again. He looked between the three of us, then took a deep breath.
I congratulate you, Sergeant Shardlake. Yes, you are right. Back in 1539, 4 years ago, I learned Goddard was inviting patients in the lay hospital to sell their teeth. The fashion for false teeth was coming in then, and he had made an arrangement with a local barber surgeon in Westminster, a man called Sneath, at the Sign of the Bloody Growth. He buys teeth and other things as well, from what I hear.
He took another deep breath and then continued.
Lockley worked with Goddard. But then everyone knew the monasteries had no future, and many of the monks tried to protect their financial security in various ways. That was the way Goddard chose, so he could preserve his status if the monastery closed. Lockley, I imagine, spent his share on drink.
How did you learn about this?
Young Cantrell told me. He worked in the monks' infirmary and had little to do with the lay hospital, but he learned what was going on. He heard Goddard and Lockley talking one day. Goddard told him to keep it quiet or he would suffer for it, but Cantrell suspected that one or two of the people Goddard and Lockley rendered unconscious for their teeth never woke up.
Cantrell, I said. He was terrified at the mention of Goddard's name. Benson continued.
I had been told by Lord Cromwell to seek out any scandals that might be going on, for use, if we needed to put pressure on the monks to surrender.
He looked at us again.
Yes, and all of you worked for him too, so you have no cause to be righteous with me. He told me to let what they were doing continue so that we could spring a trap if need be, make a scandal of it. But his preference was for the monastery to be closed quietly and peacefully without scandal, because that is what the king wanted. And that is what I achieved.
Did Goddard know Cantrell had informed on him?
No. I never told him I knew.
So more people could have died, Harsnett said.
Perhaps. I was under Lord Cromwell's orders. As all of you know, one didn't defy those lightly.
He leaned forward, regaining confidence now.
And the king wouldn't like to hear a scandal about Westminster, even now. I obeyed Lord Cromwell because he had all the power then, though I had no sympathy for his extreme radicalism in religion. But I knew he would go too far, and his enemies on the council would bring him down, which is what happened. And now we're going back to more sensible ways.
So you swung with the wind, Harsnett said.
Better swinging with the wind than swinging in the wind, as many have.
Benson pointed a stubby finger at the coroner.
The king knows nothing of this, does he? This killer you're seeking? I have been making soundings. Oh, very discreetly, don't worry. The king would not be glad to hear Archbishop Cranmer had been keeping things from him, not at this time when there are so many voices raised against him.
He turned to me.
Your search doesn't go well, does it? You seem to be caught up in a nasty tangle, Master Crookback. You wouldn't want to annoy the king a second time.
Harsnett turned to me, ignoring Benson.
Where does this leave us? Is the killer some demented ex-patient of theirs?
I doubt it, I said. They were poor, helpless folk. Yet there's some link. There has to be.
It's Goddard, Harsnett said. He's choosing victims he knows.
He looked at the Dean.
You've told us everything.
All now. On my oath as Dean of Westminster.
I know how much that is worth, sir, Harsnett replied, his voice full of contempt.
Benson glared at him, then turned to me.
Am I safe?
He asked.
I don't think you're at risk, I replied. All five victims so far were associated with radical religion and moved away from it. But you, I think, were always a time server, I dared to say.
A practical man, as I told you before, Master Crookback.
Outside the house, Harsnett shook his head.
We're no further forward, I said. At least we know how ruthless and indeed cruel both Lockley and Goddard could be. Why could Benson not tell us earlier about that scheme? He knows he's safe, he added bitterly.
I didn't reply. It occurred to me that the aggressive way Harsnett had tackled Dean from the beginning hadn't helped. He had been ruled by his dislike of the man. Sometimes, dealing with political creatures, one must dissemble and pretend friendship, as they do.
And why didn't Cantrell tell us about this either? He asked.
Too afraid, I should think. It didn't do him much good telling Benson. We'd better go and see what he says now. We can leave the horses here. I pointed to the door in the wall leading to Dean's yard.
There, that's where he lives. Though exists might be a better word.
We went out and crossed the road to the tumble-down shop.
I see no guard, Harsnett said.
Knowing him, he may have refused to have one.
Then he must be made to.
There, I agree. We crossed the road and knocked at the door. After a moment, Cantrell opened it.
It is you again, sir,
he said without enthusiasm.
He peered at Harsnett through his glasses.
Who is this?
I am the London Assistant Coroner, Harsnett said mildly enough. Master Shardlake is working with me. We wanted to see how you fared. We hope to see a guard at the house.
He's out the back.
May we come in?
Cantrell's shoulders sagged wearily as we followed him down the musty corridor to the parlour, Harsnett leading the way. The place still smelled of unwashed skin and bad food. We went into the dirty little parlour. I saw the window to the yard had been repaired. Outside, a burly man wearing a sword sat on an old box eating bread and cheese. Cantrell gestured at him.
He insisted. I don't want a man in the house. He can stay out there.
I looked round the parlour. There was a broken dish on the floor by the table, pottage leaking into the floorboards.
My dinner, Cantrell said gloomily. I dropped it when you knocked. I tried to put it on the table but missed.
You should get your eyes seen to, I said. Remember I said I know a physician who would see you for no fee?
I would pay Guy's fee, I decided. If I could do it for Belknap, I could do it for poor Cantrell.
Cantrell stared at me. I wondered what his eyes looked like exposed, what disease ailed them. He was silent a moment, then said,
I am afraid, sir. Afraid he will say I'm going blind.
Or he may say new glasses would help you. Let me make an appointment.
How long will I have to have that man here guarding me?
He asked sullenly.
He may be needed for some time yet, Harsnett said. I have to tell you that Francis Lockley has disappeared and the woman he was living with has been killed. The man who broke in here, could it possibly have been Lockley?
Cantrell stared at us, his mouth falling open with surprise.
No, it wasn't Francis. He was short, and the man who broke in here was tall. Dr. Goddard was a tall man.
With a large mole on the side of his nose, Sergeant Shardlake said?
Yes.
And with a cut on his head after you thwacked him with that piece of wood, Barrack added approvingly.
I don't know, I don't know,
Cantrell said with sudden petulance.
Why do you all have to come here asking me questions? I don't understand what's happening. I just want to be left alone, in peace.
Harsnett looked at him without speaking for a moment, getting his attention.
We have just been to see Dean Benson, he said. He told us about the wretched scheme of Goddard and Lockley's, extracting patients' teeth under Dwale. He told us you reported them to him.
Why didn't you tell me? I asked. Cantrell sank down on a stool, a gesture of utter weariness.
Is that why Dr. Goddard is after me? He asked. Because I told.
Dean Benson never told Goddard about that, I said. But why did you not tell me?
Much good it did me when I told on him the first time. I always suspected Dr. Goddard guessed what I'd done, though he never said anything. His tongue seemed harsher than ever after that.
The young man sighed deeply.
It does no good trying to do right. It's better to be left alone.
He looked up at us with those huge swimming eyes behind his glasses.
It wasn't just patients they took teeth from, you know. Word got around among the beggars and peddlers that there was money to be had with no pain for young folks with good teeth. Many healthy folks came to the infirmary.
I thought suddenly of the attractive young woman I had seen yesterday.
Dr. Goddard could pick and choose. I was always surprised nobody in authority knew. All the beggars did. But no one takes notice of beggars, do they?
He relapsed into silence, staring at the floor.
I will have a word with the guard.
Harsnett looked at Cantrell, shook his head, then went out of the back door. He spoke briefly with the guard, then returned.
There's been nothing suspicious while he's been here. But he's unhappy at not being allowed into the house. He even has to sleep in the shed, which is full of old carpenter's junk. Why will you not let him in, good man Cantrell?
I just want to be left alone,
Cantrell repeated. I feared he might burst into tears. I put a hand on Harsnett's arm, and he followed me out of the parlour. I turned in the doorway and spoke to Cantrell. I'll speak to my physician friend. I'll arrange an appointment for you.
He didn't reply, just sat looking at the floor.
Outside, Harsnett shook his head again.
The smell of that place. Did you see how dirty his clothes were?
Yes, he is in a bad way, poor creature.
Going the same way as Adam Kite, by the looks of him, Barrack said.
I will help him if I can, I said.
You would help all the mad folks in London. They'll drive you as mad as they.
Sergeant Shardlake merely wishes to help, Harsnett said reprovingly. I rubbed my arm at a sudden twinge from my wound.
How is your arm? Harsnett said. I forgot to ask.
Much better, but I've just had the stitches out. I hope that guard knows his business. I don't want to lose Cantrell too.
Harsnett looked at me. I could see that, like Barrack, he thought I was getting too involved in the troubles of the young ex-monk.
He's competent enough. He's the last man I have. If we need any more, we'll have to rely on Sir Thomas Seymour.
He sighed heavily.
In the end, it will be as God wills.
Harsnett returned to his office at nearby Whitehall, and Barrack and I rode home along the Strand. It was late afternoon now, and the shadows were lengthening.
What the hell happened in that tavern last night? Barrack asked. Is Lockley the killer, and killing his wife part of his plan? If that was so, surely he'd leave her to the end, as the seventh victim, not reveal his identity now.
I can't see him as the killer. He doesn't have the fierce, cold intelligence the killer must have. Unless he's a good actor. Guy says the killer must be acting most of the time to be able to pretend to be normal. I shook my head. But how could Lockley know anything about the law, enough to prepare that letter for Roger?
I don't know. I can't see it being Goddard either, though. It doesn't feel right somehow.
I agree. Dr. Goddard sounds more and more like a man obsessed with status and money, not with religious feeling. Barrack grinned sourly.
Unlike our pure brother, Coroner Arsnett.
He's not so bad. He has some good qualities.
He'd like to convert you. Make you a godly man too, he snorted. How could anyone believe in a merciful God after what we've seen in that tavern?
I suppose some would say that God gives man free will, and if he abuses it, that's his doing, not God's.
Try telling that to Mrs. Bunce.
As we turned into Chancery Lane, I remembered that I'd agreed to see how Adam Kite was faring, and I must ask Guy to see Cantrell. I could understand the young man's fear. What if Guy told him he would end wholly blind? We took the horses round to the stable, then went into the house. As soon as I opened the door, Joan came hurrying down the stairs.
"Dorothy Elliard's maid Margaret has been round with a message," she said.
"Has something happened to her?" My heart was suddenly in my mouth.
"No, she's all right. But she has a Master Beelnap in her lodgings. He collapsed on her doorstep. Margaret says he's at death's door."
"Beelnap?" I asked incredulously.
"But he barely knows Dorothy." "That was the message, sir. It came half an hour ago. Margaret asked you to go over there as soon as you return."
"I'll go now." I opened the door and hurried back down the path, walking rapidly round to Lincoln's Inn, where candles were being lit in the windows as darkness fell. Margaret let me in, her plump face anxious. "What is going on?" I asked.
"I heard a knocking at the door early this afternoon, sir, and when I answered, I found this man in a barrister's robe collapsed on the doorstep. The mistress got the cook to put him to bed. He said you knew him."
"I'm in here,"
Dorothy called from the parlour.
"I'd better go back to him, sir," Margaret said. "He's in a bad way."
She hurried away with the rustle of skirts. I went into the parlour where Dorothy was standing by the fire, studying the discoloured section of the wooden frieze.
"I must get this section redone. It was so poorly repaired. It irritates me now I spend so much time sitting here."
Her face was pale and I sensed she was making an effort to stay calm.
"Thank you for coming, Matthew."
"What has happened? Why is Beelnap here?"
"Margaret found him collapsed on the doorstep, asking for help. She called me. He was lying there white as a sheet, gasping for air."
There was a slight tremble in her voice. I realized the sight must have brought back the memory of Roger lying by the fountain. Damn Belknap, I thought. Margaret said you've put him to bed. She spread her hands. What else could I do? He said he was dying, asked for my help. Though I barely knew him and liked him no better than you did. He knew a woman wouldn't turn him away. I frowned. I'll go and deal with him.
Matthew, Dorothy said quietly, don't be too harsh. I think he is very ill.
We'll see. They'd put Belknap in a bedroom. From the schoolboy-sized tennis racket on a wooden chest, I guessed it was Samuel's old room. Margaret was leaning over the bed, trying to get Belknap to drink something from a cup. He lay on the bed in his shirt. I was shocked by how bad he looked. His face against the pillows as pale as death in the light of the candle on the bedside table. He was conscious, though. He stared at me with wild, terrified eyes. Margaret turned to me. She looked distressed. She, too, had seen Roger's corpse.
I'm trying to get him to drink some weak beer, she said.
Leave us, I said gently. She put down the cup and left the room. I looked down at Belknap. It was a strange thing to see him so close up and so helpless. His disordered yellow hair was thinning, a large bald patch at the crown. Some of the drink Margaret had given him had spilled around his mouth. He looked utterly helpless, and his frantic stare showed he knew it. "Why have you come here?" I asked quietly. "You know what this household has suffered."
"I knew Mistress Elliard was still here."
His voice was faint, his breath rasping.
"I knew she was kind. I have no one else to help me."
"Anyone would help a fellow barrister in a state of collapse."
"Not me. Everyone hates me."
He sighed, closed his eyes for a moment.
"I'm finished, Shardlake. I can't eat. The food just passes through me. Dr. Archer said the last purge will wear off, but it hasn't. And I bleed sometimes. I bleed down there."
I sighed. "I'll arrange for Dr. Moulton to come and see you here."
"I think it's too late. My vision blurs. I feel faint all the time."
With a great effort, he pulled a skinny hand from beneath the covers and grasped my wrist. I tried not to flinch at the unexpected gesture.
"I have never believed in God,"
he whispered, still fixing me with his agonized gaze.
"Not since I was a child. The world is a battleground, predators and prey. The rules and conventions of the law only disguise the fact. But now I'm frightened. The Catholics say if you confess your sins and repent at the end, God will receive you into heaven. I need a priest, one of the old type."
I took a deep breath. "I'll have Dr. Moulton fetch now, and he may know a priest who will confess you. But I think, Belknap, with proper treatment, you may come round. I'll send Margaret back in." I tried to rise, but he still held me fast by the wrist, his grip surprisingly strong.
"You believe, don't you?"
he asked. I hesitated.
"I have no certainty.
I haven't had for some time." He looked surprised.
"I always thought you did. All your concern for rules and ethics, the way you always looked down on me, I thought you were one of the godly folk."
"No."
"Then why help me now, when you hate me? I've done some hard things to you. Because you looked down on me as though I were a louse, not a man."
A brief flash of anger in the pale eyes. "You're still a fellow human being." Belknap seemed to think for a moment. He bit his lip, showing long yellow teeth. Then he said,
"The priest may not come in time. At least I can tell you about one sin. Tell you what I did. Though I don't know why he asked."
"What do you mean, Belknap?
You're making no sense.
He closed his eyes.
Near 2 weeks ago, after you lost me the case involving that Marsh Cotter, the next day a man called at my chambers. His name is Colin Feldday.
He paused for breath.
He's a solicitor. He hangs around the Westminster Sanctuary looking for clients, and I'm one of the barristers he brings them to. Not a respectable man, one of those you would disapprove of.
He tried to laugh, but the cracking sound turned into a cough. He opened his eyes again, full of fear and pain.
He said he had a client who would pay good money for information I could give him about you.
What sort of information?
Anything I could give. About your work habits, where you lived, even about what sort of man you were. About your man, Barrack.
I told him you were a starchy prig, bitter about your fate as a hunchback.
I said you were a persistent lawyer, like a damn terrier dog. And no fool.
He tried to laugh again.
Oh, no, never that.
I stared down at him. This was the killer. It must be. This was how he'd found out about me. This solicitor had perhaps written to Roger at his instruction.
Who is Felday's client?
I asked sharply. What's his name?
He said he couldn't tell me that, only that he wished you no good. That was enough for me.
His eyes were full of anger now. This might be a confession, but I saw there was no real contrition, only terrible fear at the prospect of death. I think Feldday's client has killed 5 people, I said. I've been hunting him, and he has been hunting me. He sliced my arm open and hurt Barrack's wife badly. Belknap's eyes slid away.
I didn't know that. No one can blame me for that.
I smiled wryly at the reappearance of the old Belknap. Somehow I knew then he would survive.
Where does Feldday live?
I asked.
Some cheap lodgings by the cathedral, Addle Hill.
I'll have Guy fetched here, I said quietly. And I'll ask about a priest. Belknap nodded weakly but didn't open his eyes. His confession had exhausted him. Or perhaps he couldn't meet my eye now. I left him, closing the door quietly behind me. Dorothy was sitting in her chair by the fire, Margaret on a stool opposite her. They both looked drained.
Margaret, I said, could you bear to go back and sit with him?
I think if you get some liquid into him, that would be good.
Is he going to die?
Dorothy asked bluntly after Margaret left the room. I don't know. He thinks he is. I'm going to have Guy fetched here. Belknap wants a priest, too. One who can confess him. She gave a mirthless laugh.
Belknap never struck me as a believer in the old ways. Or in anything, save lining his pockets.
I think for him, it's a sort of insurance. I shook my head. He is a strange man. It's known he has a massive chest of gold locked away in his chambers. But no wife, no friends, only enemies. What drove him to be so?
Dorothy shook her head. Who can say? Well, I hope he lives. I wouldn't want another death here. Thank you for coming, Matthew.
She smiled.
Margaret and I, we didn't know what to do. Somehow we couldn't think.
That's hardly surprising in the circumstances. She got up.
At least let me give you some supper. I'll wager you haven't had any.
No, there's something I must do urgently.
About these killings?
Yes, a possible lead. She came over to me and took my hand. She looked down at it.
You have been through so much. You look more tired than ever.
I think we may be near the end of the trail.
Seeing that man Belknap lying on the doorstep so white, it brought everything back. When I first saw Roger's body.
Suddenly she burst into tears, bringing her hands up to her face. I forgot myself and took her in my arms.
Oh, Dorothy.
Poor Dorothy.
She looked up at me with a tear-streaked face, looked into my eyes, and I felt if I kissed her now she would respond. But then she blinked and took a step back. She smiled sadly.
Poor Matthew, she said quickly, running from pillar to post to help me.
Whatever I can do, at any time.
I know,
she answered quietly. I bowed and went out. On the front doorstep I paused, suddenly overcome with emotion. She did feel something for me, I felt that now. I looked out over Gatehouse Court. It was dark, only a few lights at the windows. I took a deep breath and began walking briskly homeward. I would send Peter to fetch Guy.
Barak and I had another mission now, to find Feldday. My heart, already beating fast, beat harder,
and my legs shook a little at the thought that perhaps at last we had found our route to the killer.